Last Sunday night, we studied Luke, the 6th chapter, verses 20 through 36, concerning a type of giving that serves as the dynamic in the task of reconciliation. And that kind of giving is the kind of giving that gives to those from whom you expect no return. And you may have thought I was putting down or was writing off reciprocal giving, the kind that we do when we exchange gifts at Christmas time. In fact, I'm sure probably some of you did. In fact, one of the kinder things that was said to me was said very lovingly by one of my sisters. She said, when you got on to that Christmas giving, she said, I thought I was going to have to come jerk you out of the pulpit. But there's a place for reciprocal giving. There's a place for giving among ourselves to express appreciation. You remember the week on Saturday night, I guess it was, Jesus was in the home of Simon the leper in Bethany. And the Mary, the woman, came and anointed him with an ointment that cost the wages of a year's wages. She poured it upon his head, and the aroma, John says, filled the whole house. And Jesus expressed appreciation. And the disciples were grumbling about it, that it could have been given to the poor, from whom you expect nothing in return. And Jesus said, well, now, leave her alone. She's done a very beautiful thing to me. You always have the poor with you. You don't always have me. And as often as you will, you can do for them. But you see, he accepted that gift. So I'm not writing off reciprocal giving. All I'm saying is, don't think that that was the mission of Jesus. It was not Jesus' mission to come and give to people from whom he would expect a return. Nor is that your mission or mine. It's not our task, it's not our mission to be giving and receiving from people from whom we hope to receive. Our task and our mission is to be about loving our enemies and giving to people from whom we do not hope to receive. And in short, doing to them what God has done for us and acting toward them as God has acted toward us. He himself is kind and generous to the unthankful and the selfish, Luke says. Now, an interesting thought in that text that was overlooked until some good brother came up and said, have you ever thought about this? And I get more good things by people coming and saying, look what I thought about and look what I discovered. The thought where it says returning or turning the other cheek, he said, have you ever thought of it on a broader basis than just the actual slapping of your face? And he said no more than that. He opened up a whole new awareness, a depth of awareness about this particular passage. The turning of the other cheek really is a figure. Now, I don't mean that it rules out the actual physical accosting of someone's face. That's not the point. But it means more than that. Look what it means in terms of human relationships. He says, if someone slaps you on the cheek, offer the other also. Turn your other cheek. What he's saying as it relates to human relationships is, whenever you are offended by someone, don't withdraw and protect yourself by drawing into a shell so that they can't get to you again. But leave yourself vulnerable. Leave yourself open. And when somebody offends you, just simply go on and leave yourself vulnerable to be offended again. Now, I know that slaps every one of us in the face. It does me. Because when you're offended by someone, you have a tendency to say, well, you're not going to get to me like that again. I'm not going to give you a chance to hurt me again. That's exactly what Jesus is saying, don't do. Because human relationships cannot be built upon that fragile basis. Don't wear your feelings on your sleeves, is what he's saying. All right, now, but that brings us to another related quality that we're going to consider this morning. Concerning our relationship to other people in this matter of reconciling relationships, relationships that are a part of this reconciliation, it brings us to our call to humility. Turn to Philippians, the 2nd chapter, please. Philippians 2 will serve as the text for the morning. We're called here in this text to humility. I tell you what, you cannot turn the other cheek until you have come to humility. Until you've decided what you're going to do with pride, you'll never turn the other cheek. You'll flare back by absolute reaction and reflex before you even know it. You've already flown off the handle. You'll never turn the other cheek until you come to humility. Let me say something else. You weren't born with it. Forget it. You weren't born with humility. You were born proud and selfish. Every one of you. Me too. We were all born like that. Looking out for number one. You weren't born with humility. Paul wasn't born with it. You didn't get it at the beginning of your journey. And once you're on the road, it's hard to come by. It doesn't come by easily. Because you have a tendency still to want to maintain that old selfish care for number one. Let's read this text and see what it says. Beginning in verse 3 of chapter 2. Do nothing from selfishness or conceit, but in humility count others better than yourselves. Let each of you not look only to his own interests, but also to the interests of others. Have this mind in you, which you have in Christ Jesus, who, though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself, taking the form of a servant, being born in likeness of men, and being found in human form, he humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even death on a cross. There are three things that are said here that relate to humility. Three expressions. Do nothing from selfishness or conceit. Count others better than yourself. And look not to your own interests only. Look to the interests of other people. And those are three of the most difficult pills to swallow when it comes to the Christian life. Do nothing from selfishness or conceit, for example. Can you say that you've achieved that one? I doubt it. Look back real quickly to Matthew, the 5th chapter, and I want to show you something that's a beautiful demonstration of this. Do nothing from selfishness or conceit. In Matthew 5, he tells about the man who was on his way to court. And he said, you better make friends with your adversary while you're on your way to the court, lest the judge take you and hand you to the guard and you be put in prison. You'll never get out till you pay the last penny. He just simply sets this talk about making friends with your adversary. You know what the word make friends means? It means to be reconciled with. This is the reconciliation we're talking about. You see, he's talking about relationships here. Be reconciled to your adversary while you're on your way to the judge. Don't wait till you get to the judge and plead your case and try to get what you're after. He said, people are more important than things. Consequently, don't go to court trying to wrangle over things. Make peace with your adversary. Life is more important than just things. People are more important than that. And watch what he does. He sets that encouragement or that advice, he sets it in the context of a whole list of things that relate to human relationships. Look at verse 21 and 22. You've heard that it was said to them of old, you shall not kill, and whoever kills shall be liable to judgment. But now watch. But I say to you that everyone that's angry with his brother is liable to the judgment. Whoever insults his brother is liable to the council. Whoever says you fool shall be liable to the hell of fire. All of these are personal human relationships. Now look at the next verse, verse 24, or verse 23 and 24. So if you're offering your gift at the altar and they remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother and then come and offer your gift. Again, he says that human relationships are more important. Well, then a lot of things. Human relationships, he says, are more important than actually worshiping. That's what he's saying here. That human relationships have to be taken care of before you can even worship God acceptably. Human relationships are more important than things, so don't go to court. You see, doing nothing from selfishness or conceit. In 1 Corinthians, the 6th chapter, he says, why not rather be wronged? That's a difficult passage. He says, you go before unbelievers to sue your own brethren. He said, that's a shame. Why not rather suffer wrong? Why not rather be wronged than to wrong somebody else? So that's the first advice he gives. Do nothing from selfishness or conceit. And that just tramples all over all of our toes, because where all of the arguments that you'll ever get into, where they center on your own interest in yourself. You don't really get into an argument about something to do that's nice for somebody else. You don't get into an argument often about insisting on seeing that other people's rights are protected. You don't really fight over things like that. Do you? Don't you get into fights over your own rights being offended and violated? If you're like me, you do. But look at the second thing he says. Count others better than yourself. Count others better than yourself. Do you do that? Well, if you do, you're able to take the lower seat in a feast. Jesus said when you go to a feast, don't sit down in the places of honor. Don't go sit at the head table. Go and sit down at the lower table or at the table at the foot of the table. Are you troubled with that? When you go to a banquet or when you go to a feast, do you like to go and sit at the head of the table? Boy, I'm thankful that doesn't bother me, aren't you? Aren't you glad that doesn't bother you? Let me show you what bothers you and bothers me too. It's not the foot of the table that gets me. That's not what puts me to the test. It's the foot of the line. The foot of the line is my test. Yeah, I don't care about the foot of the table. Just so it's a table where I can set my plate and sit in my chair and eat. You can have the head or the toe. I don't care. Just let me have a place to sit down and eat. And I would have to translate this passage here that count others hungrier than yourself. If you'll translate it, count others hungrier than yourself, you'll find out where your real priorities lie. Are you willing to... And I tell you what, I have to watch my wife. She'll pull on my coat, you know, when they'll say, all right, let's all go up and get our food. I find her almost pulling on my coat saying, don't go up first, Jim, wait. And that's where it really puts me to the test. Count others hungrier than yourself. Or when you're... Do you ever go into a conversation where two people are there standing and you just go up there and you figure that what you've got to say is so important that what? I see you know what I'm talking about, that you have to butt in because what you're saying is more important than what that other fellow's telling him. Have mercy. How many of you have ever done that? You ever do that? Let me see your hands. You might as well confess it now. See there? I have. Woo! Mercy. Count others hungrier than yourself. Count others... What they're talking about more importance than what you're going to talk about. Then thirdly, he says, look not just to the things of your own interest, but to the interests of other people. What do you talk about when you're in conversation with people? Do you find yourselves talking and all of a sudden you realize that you've been talking about yourself for the last 10 minutes? What do you talk about? And to what do you show an interest in? Do you show a genuine interest in what the other fellow's talking about? I mean a real interest where you're able to sit and listen and pick him and pick his brain and ask him, well, what did you mean by doing that? Why did you do that? Or what happened then? Go on. Yeah, you were talking, but you didn't finish. What were you saying? Are you able to do that? Or are you one of those that listens just long enough to wait until the other fellow breathes and then you're in there you're in there telling about something that happened to you that was just a whole lot better and, you know, one-upmanship was born on that bed right there of looking to the interests of yourself rather than the interests of other people. Really, you've really got something better. And somebody said the first man that tells that a fishing tale doesn't have a chance because everybody else's tale is always bigger than the one that was told before. Let me ask you another question. When it says looking not just to your own interests but to the interests of others, he wasn't talking about just things that were interesting. Interests here represents need. When you bargain with someone, when you're buying a car, or when you're buying anything for that matter, and the man comes down and you've got him down $150, and you finally drew him on down to where absolutely, he's just bleeding, he's hurting, his profit's gone out the window. He makes his living by this process of selling and buying and selling, and you have now come in and you've got him right down to the bare minimum where he may come out even. Now, do you bargain like that? Well, let me say to you, you ought to be ashamed of yourself if you do. When you get a man down to where he just simply cannot go any lower, then give him $50 more and say, I'll take it. And he'll say, what do you mean, 50? Well, you know what? You make your living this way. I don't make my living buying and selling. This fellow does. Then let him have what he needs in order to make a living. And the standard you go by is simply the standard that Jesus said, as you would that men would do to you, you do so to them. How would you like for somebody to bargain you right down to where you couldn't make but maybe just a dime or two? You wouldn't like that. Then don't do him that way. Look out for his interest, not just for your own. And I know you may say, well, but he'll skin me. Well, I doubt it. If you'll look out for his interests, he won't skin you. And if he does, You can probably live with that anyway. Do nothing from selfishness or conceit. Count others better than yourself. Look to the interests of others. And if you'll remember in all of this that our mission is not things, it's what? It's people. Our mission is people. We're to fight not for things. We're to fight for whom? Fight for people. Not with people. Fight for them. And when the world comes to find out that you're fighting for them, you're going to have more fellowship and more association than you can probably handle. Now, look again at the second part. We're called to humility by an example. Who do you reckon he would refer to as an example of humility? Jesus Christ. Have this mind in you which you have in Jesus Christ, though he was in the form of God. And that's where the emphasis lies. Though he was in the form... He's not talking... The emphasis here is not on form. The emphasis here is on God. He says, now I want to show you something. Look at Jesus Christ and have the mind in you that he had, though he was in the form of God. What's he say it like that for? For the simple force of extremity? This is an extreme situation here. This man was actually in the form of God himself. Now, he says, I want to show you what he did. Though he was in the form of God, he didn't consider even being on equality with God a thing to be held on to selfishly. That's what the word grasp means there. He did not consider equality with God a thing to be grasped. Did you ever grab something and hold, you know, you do that with toys? Man, yeah. Grab that car and hold it, you're not. Or grab that ball and or the bat. You're not, and just one bat. I'll just take it and go home. And everybody stands around hoping you won't, you know, until you get your way. And when you get your way, then you're all smiles and here you go again. We're going to play with the ball and bat again. If I don't get my way, I'll just take my ball and go home. I know you've either said that verbatim or you've said it inferring it. If anyone ever had the right to be proud, if anyone ever had the right to be unyielding, if anyone ever had the right to be crabby or self-centered, it was Jesus Christ. He was in the form of God. But now watch, these three things that I mentioned just a moment ago, the three that count others better, that do nothing from selfishness or conceit, count others better than yourself, and look to the interests of others. Notice, if you will, whenever Paul refers to Jesus as the example, he lists it in these three same categories. Now watch what it says. He did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but he emptied himself. What is that equivalent to? What's that parallel to in the passage just above? Look what it says. Do nothing from selfishness or conceit. What did Jesus do to show us that? He says he did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped. That would be conceit. But he emptied himself. That's the opposite of selfishness. So we have him as an example of doing nothing from conceit and nothing from selfishness. But look at the second thing, taking the form of a servant. Taking the form of a servant. That's parallel to counting others better than himself. You're not going to serve somebody if you think that you're better than they are. I mean, really think it. If you really and truly think that you're better than someone, you're not going to be found serving them. You're going to be incensed that they would even think it. You're going to be expecting them to get up and do the serving of you. You're not going to serve somebody if you think that you're better than that person. But look what this produced in the life of Jesus. And if you can reconcile how he could be aware of his being God and at the same time consider other people better than himself, how could he do that? I don't quite know. I don't understand it. He was aware of who he was, and he was aware of who they were, and yet he counted them as better than himself in terms of what their needs were. Notice, if you will, Jesus, because of the fact that he took the form of a servant, was able to take the lower seat in a feast. Now, that's what he taught. But I want you to do something, and this startled me when I found it this week. I want you to envision all of life as a banquet table. All of life as a banquet table. Now I want to ask you a question. Where do we find Jesus Christ at the banquet table of life? At what table? At the head or at the foot? Now, all of life is a banquet table. You see, he said when you go to a banquet, don't go to the head seat. Go down to the foot. Now, if you look at the whole of life as a banquet table, and when Jesus came and lived his life among us, at which end of the table did he sit? Constantly, he sat at the foot of the table. In Luke, the 5th chapter, verses 29 through 32, look back there real quickly, because that describes where Jesus sat at these feasts, at the Feast of Life. Levi made a great feast, 5:29 of Luke. Levi made a great feast in his house. There was a large company of tax collectors and others sitting at table with them. Verse 30, and the Pharisees and their scribes murmured against his disciples, saying, why do you eat with tax collectors and sinners? Why do you eat at the foot of the table? That's what he was asking him. These people who were so accustomed, and back up in Luke 14, they were so accustomed at sitting and choosing out the places of honor, when the Pharisees and the scribes and all, when they were around a feast, they were always scrounging around for the chief seats and the places of honor. When Jesus went to a feast, they saw him sitting down at the foot of the table. They said, why are you sitting down here at the foot of the table? And look what he did. When he was asked why he did this, look at his answer in verse 31. And Jesus answered them, those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. Now I want to see if you, do you understand what he did there? When they asked him, why are you sitting here at the foot of the table? What did he answer? What was his answer? Why did he answer like he did? And what did he answer? What did he refer to? Why are you down here with all these people? What did he refer to? Why do you sit at the foot of the table? What did he say? He referred to whose needs? He referred to whose interests? Not his own. He said, those who are well don't have any need, but those who are sick. That astonishes me. It astonishes me that whenever he was asked, why are you down here at the foot of the table, and why did he spend his life among that kind of people? He said, well, it's because those are the ones who have need. And so he fulfilled number three, and that is he looked not to his own interests, but to the interests of other people. Listen, this passage in Philippians 2, where it says, being found in human form, he humbled himself. That's a two-step humility. Being found in human form, he humbled himself. It could have said something else. Being found in human form, he decided to make the best of a messy, stinking situation. It could have said that. Being found in human form meant that he, in a sense, came to, and he was down here on this blob of dirt. Now, I don't know when he became conscious of being God. I don't know when he did. But it says, being found in human form, as though when he came to himself, and he looked around and he thought, what in the world have I done? Now, that could have been his reaction. And he could have set himself about to be proud, hard to get along with, and he was going to get the most out of an unseemly situation, and he was going to make everybody suffer for his having been here. That could have happened to him had he not been God. But listen, every last one of us finds ourselves sitting in a situation that we really didn't create. He didn't create the mess that's here on earth, and yet he found himself sitting right in the middle of it. What did he do? What do you do? Look, your dorm room is just a miniature world. That's all it is. And when you come into your dorm room, what do? Well, you make the best of a stinking situation. Your roommates aren't this, you know, the roommates aren't that, and your suite mates. And so you find yourself hard to get along with, and you're just going to be grumpy, and you're going to be grouchy. Well, that's one way of reacting. Everybody, you listen, your job at work, it's just another miniature world. You get in there with your boss, and he's crabby and gripey. What are you going to do? Well, you go off and you grumble, and you say, well, I tell you, well, that's one way to react, but watch what Jesus did. Having been found in human form, he humbled himself. He humbled himself. Oh, my. And being found in his dorm room, he humbled himself. Being found at work, he humbled himself. Being found in a home that was, you know, that's not all that pleasant and not all that perfect, he humbled himself. Being found married to a woman or to a man that's not quite what he would like, he humbled himself. He became obedient to death, death on a cross. And that's the extent, that's the extreme expression of looking out after others' interests and not his own. It wasn't in his interest for himself to die on the cross. That was in our interest. So you find Jesus here, being the perfect example of what he's calling us to. Do nothing from selfishness or conceit, but in humility count others better than yourselves. Let each of you look not only to his own interests, but also to the interests of others. Have this mind among yourselves, which you have in Christ Jesus, who, though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself, taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men, and being found in human form, he humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even death on a cross. Now, here's something I think that's interesting. Do you want to see the total parallel between Philippians 2, 3 through 11 and the incident of where the story Jesus told about going to a banquet and sitting at the lower table. Now watch the two parallels. Jesus taught while he was on earth. He said, when you go to a banquet, don't choose the seats of honor. Choose the lower seats. And then when the one that invited you comes, he's going to say, what are you doing sitting here? You come on up here where you belong. And he put you up here and you'll receive honor by everyone. Now in Philippians, the Philippian writer said when Jesus Christ was here, he did not count being on an equality with God a thing to be grasped. He didn't insist on sitting at the head table. But he took himself and went down to the foot of the table and stayed there. And then watch what he says and in verse 9 of Philippians 2. After it says he humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even death on a cross. Now watch, here comes the man that invited us all into this life. Therefore God has highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name that's above every name. That is, at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. So you see this, the total parallel between the humbling of ourselves and the exalting. That's what happened in Jesus' life, and he says that's what's going to happen in your life. He says, humble yourselves under the hand of God, and he'll exalt you. And everyone that humbles himself will be exalted. He that exalts himself will be humbled. So in your relationships with other people, how are you handling them? If you're looking out for your own interests, you're not going to make many friends. You're not going to build many bridges. If you consider yourself better than other people, you might as well write off any real relationships, any reconciling relationships. If you do things from selfishness or conceit, you can see how that would just destroy relationships. And it will. Let's sing that song, Humble Yourself in the Sight of the Lord, because that's what really this is saying. And that's taken from 1 Peter. Let's sing it before we even sing this other one. Humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord. Humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord. And he will lift you up. And he will lift you up. Humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord. Humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord. And he will lift you up. And he will lift you up. Can you swallow that pill or not? Humility, as it is the dynamic of reconciling relationships. We're going to sing this song that we've announced as the invitation. Oh, to be like thee, blessed Redeemer, this is my constant longing and prayer. Let's sing that to one another and encourage one another while we stand and sing.